Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now in Psalms chapter 90, which I will entitle Life is Short. The psalm, Psalms 90, is the first psalm in book 3 of the Psalms. Our book of Psalms is divided into 5 books, and we are now starting with the 3rd book of the Psalms. Book 3 contains Psalms 90 through 106. The heading of the psalm states simply, a prayer of Moses, the man of God. Now, that's sort of strange, Moses being the author of a psalm. Now, some people say he did write the psalm, but this does seem strange because Moses lived so much earlier than the other psalmists. If he were the author, the psalm would be passed down from generation to generation to the time of the other psalmist, like David's time, for example. David ruled 1010 to 970 B.C. Moses was around mid-15th century B.C. Now, Moses was a poetic man. He had 2 songs of Moses in the Torah. The first song of Moses was in Exodus 15. The second song of Moses was in Deuteronomy 32. Well, other people say, no, Moses didn't write the psalm. The psalm was written by another unknown psalmist. And the reason why Moses was in the title could be for several reasons, a couple of reasons. A prayer of Moses could mean that the psalm was written in the spirit of Moses, so the of Moses is not precise. It doesn't mean that the psalm was written by Moses. Or it could be the psalm was written as a tribute to Moses. A prayer of Moses, in other words, a prayer of tribute to Moses. All that speculation, just to make it easier, I'm going to say Moses wrote the psalm, so I will refer to the psalmist as Moses if you will just hold a caveat in your brain and realize that the authorship is not established beyond doubt. So we start now with verses 1 and 2 of Psalms 90. Lord, Moses says, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Now, in verse 1, we have an interesting turn of phrase. Moses says, you, God, have been our dwelling place. We live in God. I just took an Old Testament biblical theology class. The whole theme of the whole Bible, according to this erudite professor, was a redeemed people living with God. For example, in the Garden of Eden, people lived with God. Mount Zion, people live with God. In the new heavens and the new earth, in the book of Revelation, we will live with God. O Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. The Septuagint has it a little bit stronger. O Lord, you have been our refuge, as in one of those rocky, craggy mountains where the enemy can't get you. So it's more like a defensive place rather than a dwelling place where we live with God in happy union. Either way, both metaphors work. Verse 2, before the mountains were born. Before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth and the world, you are God. From everlasting to everlasting, before the mountains were born, that means that God was in existence before his creation was in existence. Creation ex nihilo. This proves that the world is not eternal, as the Greeks and the Chinese and their philosophy like to say. No, the world is not eternal. It was created by God. We go down to Psalms 90, verses 3 through 6. Moses says, you, God, turn man back into dust and say, return, O children of men, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it passes by, or as a watch in the night. You have swept them away like a flood, they fall asleep. In the morning they are like grass which sprouts anew. In the morning it flourishes and sprouts anew, toward evening it fades and withers away. Verse 3, the psalmist says, you turn man back into dust, that means you basically cause men to die. And then, God, you say, return, O children of men. Adam Clark says that means return to life. And thus, Psalms 90, verse 3, is a clear promise of the resurrection of the human body. Well, I love verses that prove the resurrection of the human body because it reminds me of my conflict with some hyper-preterist heretics who don't believe in the resurrection of the human body, the physical resurrection of it. But I don't think that's what is being talked about here. I think Jameson, Fossey, and Brown are more accurate when they say, when God says return, O children of men, he's saying return back to the dust and death where you came from. And as you see as we go through this, the context fits that perfectly. Life is short. You're going to go back to the dust. Jameson, Fossey, and Brown supports that idea. That return means return to the dust and death. Genesis 3:19, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown quote, "By the sweat of your face you will eat bread till you return to the ground, till you die. Because from it you were taken, from the ground you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return." There's that word return again. So I think the psalmist is reflecting the language in Genesis. Return, O children of men, return to the dust. Verse 4, "For 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it passes by." Time passes quickly with God because there's no time in God. 1,000 years, 2,000 years, 1,000,000 years, what difference does it make? He sees time all at once. He sees the past, the present, and the future all at once, whereas we can only see the present. We remember the past and we anticipate the future, but we only see the present. Now, this 1,000 years, of course, is from God's point of view, 1,000 years in your sight. So on God's divine time, things are passing pretty quick. In fact, there's no time at all, so time passes infinitely fast. But in our time, 1,000 years is 1,000 years. It takes a long time. It takes 1,000 times 365 revolutions of the earth around the sun, and that's a long time. So the purpose of verse 4 is to express the difference between an immortal God and mortal man. We think our 70 years or so are so important, but 70 years or so fades into insignificance when compared to the longevity of God. As I said earlier, time passes quickly with God because there is no time with God. Now, Peter is thought to have quoted Psalms 90 verse 4 and 2 Peter 3:8, "But do not let this one fact escape your notice, beloved, that with the Lord one day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years like one day." Now, this is verses to explain why the long time of waiting for Jesus' coming for humans is not so long for God. And I believe in 2 Peter 3:8, he's talking about the coming of Jesus to judge the Jews for crucifying Jesus is what he's talking about, because I'm an Orthodox preterist. I realize that a lot of people talk about the coming of Jesus, which seems to last so long for humans, is referring to the second coming at the end of time, or the final coming. And that's fine. It doesn't matter what your view is on that. The point is the time frame is God's time frame. On the divine chronological scale, time passes very, 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 very quickly. But on the human time scale, time passes very slow. And we think about that when we are in trials and we say, "How long, O God, how long?" We'll see a how long in this particular psalm. But to God, it's not long to him at all, but to us, it is a long time. Now, I will point out that this verse, 2 Peter 3:8, is wrongly used by futurists to say that all the soons in the book of Revelation, they refer to thousands of years, because when Jesus says, "I'm coming soon," well, what does soon mean? It doesn't mean thousands of years. And they say, yes, but on God's time frame, it's soon for him. It's not soon for us, but it's soon for him. But for us, it's thousands of years in the future. To which I say, who was God speaking to in the book of Revelation? Who were the angels or Jesus speaking to John when he says Jesus is coming soon, morning or night or noon? When he said Jesus is coming soon, he was talking to human beings, and he expected them to process that word soon on a human timescale. So it means soon from the human point of view, not soon from God's point of view. Therefore, the book of Revelation is talking about events which were going to happen within the next decade or so, which is pretty soon. All of this is true if you're an Orthodox preterist, which I hope you will one day become. Now, in verse 4, the psalmist continues with this idea of how time passes so quickly for human beings. Our life is like a watch in the night. Well, how long is a watch? Well, it's either 3 or 4 hours, depending on how the nighttime hours were divided. There were 3 Jewish watches, which had 4 hours each. And later on, when the Romans took over, there were 4 Roman watches, each of which had 3 hours. So it's either 3 or 4 hours. That's pretty short for a lifetime. So the point is made, regardless of which watch is being referred to here in verse 4. Now, out of curiosity, I looked up the exact nomenclature for the watches and also the links for the watches. And so it's a rabbit trail, but I'm going to go through it here for you. Let's take the Jewish watches first. I got this from Smith's Bible Dictionary. The first watch, as it was called, was from sunset to 10 p.m. The middle watch, as it was called by the Jews, was from 10 p.m. to 2 p.m. You notice that's 4 hours. The third watch which was called the morning watch by the Jews, that went from 2 o'clock in the morning to sunrise. Now, later when the Romans took over Israel, the Romans used 4 watches, each of which contained 3 hours. Now, they would label the watches with the first 4 ordinal numbers, first, second, third, or fourth watch, but they also had other names too. The first Roman watch was called the even watch or the evening watch. It was from sunset to 9 p.m. The second Roman watch was called the midnight watch, and it was from 9 p.m. to 12 a.m., midnight. The third Roman watch was called the cock crowing watch, which was from 12 o'clock a.m., midnight, to 3 o'clock a.m. And the fourth Roman watch was called the morning watch, and that ran from 3 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock a.m. All right, returning from the rabbit trail, we go back to our main theme here, that life is short. Verse 5, Moses says, "You, God, have swept them away, the children of men. Like a flood, they fall asleep, all of us." Boom! They're born, and then they're gone. They fall asleep. That means they die. In the morning, they are like grass which sprouts anew. Well, they're born, and here they are, ready to face the day. And one day goes by, in verse 6, in the morning, the grass flourishes and sprouts anew. Toward evening, it fades and withers away. In other words, the lifetime of a human being is a day long. Flourishes quickly, dies just as quick. Great poetry here to illustrate the main point. Life is short. Man's life compared to God's life is about a day long, because God's eternal. We might live to be like Methuselah, 900 years, but 900 years compared to God's eternality is very, very short. Let's look at some other verses that talk about the withering grass of mankind. Psalms 37:2. This is a psalm of David, who says, "For they," referring to evildoers, "will wither quickly like the grass and fade like the green herb." 1 Peter 1:24. For, Peter says, "All flesh is like grass, and all its glory like the flower of grass. The grass withers, and the flower falls off." Now, Peter is quoting Isaiah 46 following. I'll quote Isaiah 46. "A voice says, call out. Then he answered, what shall I call out? All flesh is grass, and all its loveliness is like the flower of the field." David wrote a psalm that said basically the same thing in Psalms 103, verse 15. "As for man, his days are like grass, as a flower of the field, so he flourishes." Flowers pop up real quick overnight. Little dandelion, little yellow flowers all through the grass. You see them. If you live in the country, you see that all the time. They don't last. They're gone by nighttime. Here's a psalm by an unknown author which expresses the same idea. Psalms 92, verse 7. "That when the wicked sprouted up like grass, and all who did iniquity flourished, it was only that they might be destroyed forevermore." Now, of course, that psalm, as well as Psalm 37, verse 2, is talking about wicked people dying very quickly. But our psalmist here in verse 90 is talking about everybody dies quickly. And last but not least, let's quote James 1, verse 10. "But the one who is rich should boast in his humiliation, because he will pass away like a flower of the field." And of course, James is talking about the evil rich who are not using their wealth wisely, the Jeffrey Epstein rich. I'm tempted to say the Bill Gates rich for all of his left-wing nonsense. James doesn't say stop being rich. He's saying that if you are rich, you need to be humble, because you're going to pass away like a flower of the field. We move now to Psalms 90, verse 7 through 10. Moses continues, "For we have been consumed by your anger, and by your wrath we have been dismayed. You have placed our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all our days have declined in your fury. We have furnished our years like a sigh. As for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strength, 80 years, yet their pride is but labor and sorrow. For soon it is gone, and we fly away." Sounds like Hank Williams, "I'll fly away, O Lord." The point is not the joy of flying away to heaven, as in that wonderful song, but the point is the shortness of life that causes us to fly away from this life after one day, or in this case, 70 years, as the metaphor shifts a little bit. Verse 7, Moses says, "We have been consumed by your anger." Well, if Moses is the author, that would refer to the Jews being in captivity in Egypt, or it could refer to the Jews in the wilderness. as they escaped from Egypt on the Exodus and yet ended up in trouble wandering around the wilderness for 38 years and traveling for 2 years before that through lots of adversity through the desert. For we have been consumed by your anger. We've been dismayed by your wrath. Verse 8, you, God, Moses says, have placed our iniquities before you, our secret sins, in the light of your presence. So God reveals secret sins. Well, what are secret sins? Well, there's a couple of ways you could read that. Secret sins could be sins that were hidden from other people. So I'm sinning, but I'm keeping other people from knowing about it. Or it could mean sins that were unknown even to the sinner. I'm not sure which way that should go. Let's read some other scriptures shedding light on this issue. Proverbs 20, verse 27. The spirit of man is the lamp of the Lord, searching all the innermost parts of his being. Well, if we have secret sins that are secret even to us, unknown to us, which we all do, well, then God searches our innermost being, the spirit of man. He has a lamp. He lights it up. And he says, okay, let's look for those sins. Now, it's okay for God to do that. That's his job. That's what he does, is he sanctifies us, is he makes us holy, as he prepares us for glorification. Unfortunately, too many Christians who are sort of scrupulous, they go looking for sins. Oh, I've got to find a sin. I've got to be holy. And what they're doing is they're relying on their own flesh to find their own sins, and they're not going to succeed because our heart hides our sins from us. We can't see them. Other people might be able to see them, and they might point them out to you, but that doesn't mean you're going to see them. Only God can reveal your sins to you, and he does it in his own good time. In his own proper sequence, he says, well, we'll take care of this sin first, and then we'll take care of that sin first, and we will sanctify you in the process as you go from glory to glory. Proverbs 20, verse 27, the spirit of man is the lamp of the Lord, searching all the innermost parts of his being. Here's a New Testament quotation from 1 Corinthians 4, verse 5. Paul says to the Corinthians, therefore do not go on passing judgment before the time, but wait until the Lord comes, who will bring forth to light the things hidden in the darkness and disclose the motives of men's hearts. And then each man's praise will come to him from God. So basically what Paul is saying, wait on the Lord, because then he will bring to light things hidden in the darkness and he will disclose men's motives. Men's motives are hidden to us. This reminds me, I just had an exchange on the internet between a brother who was convinced that a certain politician from my home state, who is not one of my favorite politicians, but my friend was convinced that this man had bad motives. He was doing something to help the evil party. I won't mention the name of that evil party. It starts with a D. And I thought to myself, how do you know this politician's motives? You can't read his mind. You don't know his heart. Only God knows. I said, you can say that this will have bad strategic consequences for his party. You can say it will have bad consequences for the government or for the country. You can say all of that. But to say that he's doing it to help the members of his opposition party, which doesn't make any sense, but to say that means that you're God. You're pretending to be God because you can search other people's motives. Folks, we can't do that. Only God can do that. So don't go on passing judgment before the time of disclosure from God, who will bring to light the things hidden in the darkness of men's souls. The spirit of man is the lamp of the Lord. He lights up your spirit to find out your secret sins. I was just talking to a young Chinese woman who just had a romantic breakup, devout Christian girl in her early 30s, and she thought she had abandoned her desire for romance and marriage. She thought she had been cured, but all of a sudden it turns out that she wasn't after the breakup, and she realized she was looking for romance, so she started watching these lousy Chinese soap operas, and believe me, you think they're bad here, they're worse in China. And she started watching those things, and pretty soon she started forgetting the Lord. And so God had to show her, as she related to me last night, she said, I thought that I was over this fleshly desire for romance. But I realize now that I wasn't. That's because God, he took off the top layer of her desire for romance, and he's working on the next layer, and I'm sure sooner or later he's going to get rid of it all. Flesh takes time to get rid of, like pus in a wound. We go down to verse 9. For all our days have declined in your fury. In other words, we've gone down, down, down in the face of God's anger. We have finished our years like a sigh. different translations for sigh. KJV says, we have finished our years like a tale that is told. In other words, it's over quickly. Somebody tells you a tale full of trifling, worthless things, and that's how your life is. Full of trifling, worthless things, and bang, it's over. The NIV says, you have finished your days with a moan. Adam Clark likes that translation. He never heard of the NIV, of course, but he says that it should be, we consume our years like a groan. In other words, we work all of our years, and then at the end we just go, finish our life with a sigh. Or we finish our life like, oh, talk about a negative confession. And then our psalmist says in verse 10, as for the days of our life, they contain 70 years. Now that's just an average amount of time. And the point is, it's very short. Life is short. Now some have foolishly claimed that this is a promise that every believer can live 70 years, which is absurd. This is the name it and claim it, blab it and grab it, mark it and park it, confess it and possess it, scream it and redeem it, folks. The Copenhagenites who say this. Here it is. There's a promise. We can live 70 years. Well, first of all, that's not necessarily a long time. I'm 70 years old right now, and I'm hoping I'll go a little bit longer than 70 years. So that's point number one. It's too short. And point number two, if you're going to claim that that verse gives you the right to live 70 years, what about the rest of the verse? Are you going to claim that verse too? Kenneth Copeland, the pride of those years is but labor and sorrow. For soon life is gone and we fly away. You going to claim that part of the verse? If you're going to claim 70 years, it's 70 years of hell, labor and sorrow. That has nothing to do with how long we live. The point is to show how short life is, contrasted with God and with eternity. Now, some people have used this 70 years that are mentioned here as an argument against the Mosaic authorship of the psalm. Here's what Adam Clark says. This psalm could not have been written by Moses because the term of human life was much more extended when Moses flourished than 80 years at the most. Even in David's time, many lived 100 years, and the author of Ecclesiasticus, who lived after the captivity, fixed this term at 100 years at the most. Well, that's an indication that Moses didn't write it, but I don't think it's dispositive because Moses picked 70 years as an average lifetime. Maybe that was an average lifetime back then, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. Moses himself lived 120 years old, as we know from Deuteronomy 34:7, but maybe he thought of himself as an exception, but he thought that most people lived about 70 or 80 years. So I'm still going to say that Moses wrote the psalm. We go now to Psalms 90, verses 11 through 17, and we will be finished with this psalm. Who understands the power of your anger, Moses continues, and your fury, God, according to the fear that is due you? So teach us to number our days, that we may present to you a heart of wisdom. Do return, O Lord, how long will it be? And be sorry for your servants. O satisfy us in the morning with your loving kindness, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad according to the days you have afflicted us and the years we have seen evil. Let your work appear to your servants and your majesty to your children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us and confirm for us the work of our hands. Yes, confirm the work of our hands. So in verse 11, the psalmist says, who understands, God, your anger, your fury, the fear that we should have of you? In other words, God's anger and fury and fear are so great that nobody can understand it. Talk about a proper fear and reverence of God. Verse 12, so teach us to number our days. Now, does that mean number our days consecutively? Our 70 or 80 years, multiply that times 365 and you get the number of your days? That's one option. Or does it mean to take one day and number how many hours are in it or how many minutes are in it? Well, I don't know, but John Gill says that we should treat the present day as if it were our last as we number our days. When you number something, you go from first to last. And so the idea is, okay, we're going to number our days. It's coming up. The expiration date, we're headed there. Or we can consider the shortness of our days. I don't really think it means to number how many hours are in the day. It could be. It probably means because our days are so few, it's easy to count them. You can't count the stars, but you can count how many years you've got in your life. Teach us that, God, Moses says, that we may present to you a heart of wisdom, so we may be wise. Do return, O Lord. What does that mean, return? As John Gill says, it means to return to those Israelites who had been alienated from God because of their sin. So return to us. Come back to us. How long will it be? Psalm 6:3, a psalm of David. And my soul is greatly dismayed, said David, but you, O Lord, how long? How long, O Lord? How many times have we said that? We could say, how long, O Lord, will you show your countenance to us again and be pleased with us again after chastising us for our iniquity? Or it can be, how long, O Lord, will you wait before you deliver us as our enemies attack us? But oftentimes God, because he's on his time schedule, not on ours, oftentimes we think it's too long. Be sorry for your servants, verse 13, be sorry for. That's an interesting translation. Have compassion for your servants. Verse 14, O satisfy us in the morning with your loving kindness. Now he's talked about God's anger and his fury and fearing God in verse 11. And now in verse 14, he's talking about God's loving kindness because God is a God of wrath and he's a God of love. And any Christian who emphasizes one over the other, are you listening, present day evangelifish? If you're just going to talk about God's love all the time, nothing wrong with talking about God's love a lot. But you better balance it off with God's justice or you will end up being warped, twisted, and confused. Satisfy us in the morning with your loving kindness that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. So the psalmist is now, Moses is now heading up for a positive end as most of the psalms. Found one that didn't end. I think it was Psalm 89 that did not end on a happy note. But most of them do. And this one is headed that way. Verse 15 says, make us glad according to the days you have afflicted us, i.e. in punishment, and the years we have seen evil, that would be punishment most probably, maybe testing. Verse 16, let your work appear to your servants and your majesty to their children. Of course, work of God could either be works of creation or works of providence in the history of Israel, or the work of creation as God created the planets, the stars, and the suns, etc. Let your work appear to your servants, that would be your slaves. The Israelites were slaves of God, and your majesty to their children. The Israelites were also children of God. Verse 17, let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and confirm for us the work of our hands. Now, I like that. Confirm for us the work of our hands. Let me read what the NIV Study Bible says. Quote, by teaching us this wisdom, our lives are brief in the scope of eternity. What we do, though it often appears insignificant, is made significant by God. He takes our efforts and gives us success and hope, infusing even the mundane with eternal value. Now, I like this verse, Psalm 90, verse 17, because oftentimes I think all the work I do and nobody cares. Sometimes spending these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours making this podcast, and I think, is anybody ever going to listen to this? Please, God, confirm for me the work of my hands. I'm working hard. I hope somebody will get the advantage of it. I hope that my life will not be worthless and irrelevant. Everybody fears that. So did the psalmist here. So he says, confirm for us the work of our hands. Put your stamp of approval on it, God. Now, of course, a lot of the work of our hands is flesh. It's no good. And that's fine. God needs to flush that away. But the things of value that we do, we need him to say, yes, well done, my good and faithful servant. With those words, we are now finished with Psalms 90. We are now prepared to go to Psalms 91, which I will entitle My Refuge and My Fortress. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.